A couple of quick notes before we get started. We're going to go right in from this into our workshops. So we may try to break about 10 minutes early from this. Mary Jo has to take off a little bit early today, around 11 or 11:15. So she will be leading a workshop. There'll be two others that I'll touch on briefly after this plenary session. And so folks who want to spend some time with her can go to that, and then they'll continue on discussing for another half an hour or so after she leaves. So we'll get started. We have a chance to hear from Mary Jo. I'm going to ask Mark to come up and open us in prayer and also give an introduction to Mary Jo.
Creator, we thank you for this misty, gray day. We thank you that you are both the stranger in our midst and the host who gathers us together. Lord, we're here because we know that within each of us is a tendency to both exclude and a desire to include. And we look at our world and we see a lot of inhospitality. Help us to be people who welcome, who embrace, who show love in the world. I pray that this time we have together today to continue to learn and discuss and just to relax and be with each other, that it would be a fulfilling time but also challenging. I pray that as we feel challenged, we wouldn't be shut down, that we'd find joy in the new possibilities that you're presenting us with. In Jesus' name we pray, amen.
Amen.
I'm excited to have Mary Jo Leddy with us. My introduction to Mary Jo was through a podcast, which is just, you know, it just sounds like something that no one would have said 10 years ago. So I do this Iconocast podcast with some others, and we've done about 50 interviews, but Mary Jo was one of the first. I think you were number 7, which is... And this is, just to give you a framework, we started doing this podcast because I noticed there's like a whole slew of people doing intentional community, young radical types, and I feel like in my kind of network, I'm kind of on the older edge of that spectrum. And then there's kind of a gap. And then there's kind of... there's elders in the movement who've been doing this stuff for longer. And I realized that as a lot of younger folks were asking questions and I was getting questions asked of me, I realized I wasn't that knowing. I didn't have a lot of wisdom. And so the podcast grew out of a desire to connect with people who've done this stuff before, who've explored the radical implications of the way of Jesus and put it into practice, that are both intellectually aware but also very practical and not disconnected. And when we interviewed Mary Jo in that spirit, I remember feeling so relieved, because one of the things that you challenged us with is this idea that we don't have to be so driven and burn ourselves out, that there's a point where you can say, it's enough. And that I was kind of offended, I think, when you said that, because this idea that somehow you can do enough, I thought, I don't want anyone off the hook. I want us to be driven until the world is better, dang it, right? That kind of a thing. But then I thought about it and realized how much peace there was in that. And so when we were talking about having a hospitality conference, I thought, you know, we should have Mary Jo come just to bring the connection between our hospitality and our spirituality. And Mary Jo, you've looked at it from all sorts of different angles, as a scholar, as an activist, as someone living in a community house. And so I'm so excited to hear what you have to say. This is Mary Jo Leddy.
Thanks very, very much, Mark, and happy to meet the man behind the microphone. It's really the first time I met Mark is here, but we had that great conversation. I took the invitation to be with you because, would you... Okay, good. It was a wonderful opportunity for me to just reflect on my own life to begin with. And I realized that I don't think that much about hospitality. And I realized that, in fact, over the years, and I've been at Romero House for 24 years now, it's kind of just become a way of life. And we take it for granted. and it's just what you do. And every so often something will happen that you get shocked into realizing this isn't sort of normal for most people. And I remember a friend of mine saying, oh, you know, we've got these relatives coming and we'd like to put them up, but we don't have room. And I said, of course you do. You've got a bathtub. And she said, what? I said, yeah, you've got a bathtub. She said, what are you talking about? And I remembered, I think what had happened to me in talking with her was that there had really been a time when we had a very serious housing shortage in the city, lots of refugees on the street, and we had a young man from the Congo came to the door, and he had been in a shelter with drug addicts, and he just couldn't take the screaming at night. It had too many memories for him. So he came to the door, and I said, we don't have any room. And he said, I'll sleep anywhere. I'll sleep in your bathtub. And I had never thought of the bathtub as a sleeping space. And we said, yes, you know, we'll kind of put something in the bottom, and if you're willing, we're willing. But it altered my imagination about the function of the bathtub. And then when my friend made this sort of normal comment about her relatives, I was shocked back into realizing that what we're doing is not normal for most people. So I have been in a situation for 24 years where I've learned to practice hospitality. And the good news is it gets easier. It just gets easier and easier and easier. Still, you stop thinking of your bathtubs in one way. And you think of it as the way you live, what you should do. And I count myself as blessed in that process. So I do think that we can talk about hospitality and have theologies of hospitality. But in the end, and this was Aristotle's view, you learn how to become hospitable by doing it. Just day after day, making mistakes, learning, growing, understanding. Gradually, you become different and you become hospitable to the point where it almost seems easy and a happy thing to do. So what I want to do, just to situate my remarks, is describe Romero House a little bit, because that's going to situate my further remarks. I mentioned to some people at breakfast that we never planned to start Romero House. It happened by accident or by providence, however you choose to see the world. But this is what happened. I was on the board of an independent left-wing Catholic newspaper, and the editor had some serious health issues, and we had to find a new editor. And the person we had in mind had two jobs, a day job and a night job. And when we offered her the job, she said, of editor, she said, I'm happy to do it, but I have these two jobs. The day job, I can easily find someone else to do. was something like teaching theology. Professors are easy to replace. But the night job, she was working as a night manager in a house for refugees run by some religious group. And she said, I really can't not be there. I can't take the job until I can find a replacement. So we said, how long would it take to find the replacement? And she said, well, about a month. And I said, well, what's involved? And she said, well, you just sleep there just to make sure, you know, if there's a fire, somebody knows what to do. So I said, well, I can do that. I'll just take your, I'll do that for a month. You take this job and here we go. That's really how it started. So I arrived at this house with my little bag, just fully intending just to sleep there at night and do my other job in the day. And I noticed very, very soon that there were two different ways of being. There was the daytime way of being and the nighttime way of being. And during the day, the refugees, and at that time, they were mostly women and children from Africa. During the day, those women and children were the clients. And the staff came in, an administrator and a social worker, and would work with people in terms of all the various things that refugees need. Schooling, healthcare, and so on. And during the day, when people weren't at school, they would be in their rooms with a door locked. And then about 5 o'clock, the staff went home, and I would be around in the evenings, and soon the women started knocking at my door, and none of them could speak English. But they said, chai. And I gathered that they were offering me tea. So there was a little common room on the first floor, and we all went down and had tea together, quietly. At first, they could understand each other, but I couldn't understand a thing. So, night after night, this started to happen, is that when the staff went home, we would go down to the main room. Somebody would make tea, no food, because they had no money, but shared what they could. And we would sit there laughing and talking. We would put on music. We would dance in a circle the way the Ethiopians do. And we communicated. And the doors were all open, all over the house. And really within about 2 weeks, I had this very simple feeling. I really like these people. I really like being with them. Then, during the day, I saw, as the staff came in, that there were a lot of monetary things that surfaced, like, we're going to pay people to shovel the snow. I said, why are you paying them? It's their house. And they said, because if you pay them, they will do what they're told, to shovel it this way, at this time, etc. So to make a really long story short, the group that ran the house was going to close it. By the time they decided that, I had already decided I liked being there. And my friends who, I couldn't really go out at night, so my friends would all come and visit me at night, and they too had tea. And we said, well, if they're going to sell it, why don't we see how we could continue this? But not in the daytime way. Not in the professional hospitality way, but just as good neighbors. Why don't we make the nighttime way the way? And just begin by living as good neighbors. And we were fortunate enough at that particular time in the city, a very enlightened city government had made it possible for small nonprofit groups to put $1,000 down on a building, on a house, and the government would guarantee a 100-year mortgage. So it sort of meant nobody would ever own that house, ever, but it would be used. And as we began to apply for it, we in fact got one, not one, but three and then four houses in that very simple economic arrangement. So I can never be totally anti-government when I see, you know, what might be possible with an enlightened housing policy. So we now, after 24 years, this is just to, again, to situate my remarks, we live in a tiny pie-shaped neighborhood that has about 8,000 people in it. It's like a small village. And within it, we have four houses in this very ordinary neighborhood that's mixed income, but mostly middle class, mixed racial, mixed religious, and so on. And the houses are all the old style Eastern houses of three stories and a basement. And they're all divided into flats. It was kind of a rooming house area. So that within each house we have 12 to 14 people, about 12 refugees, men, women, and children, and two people, myself and seven young interns who are usually in their 20s, have usually finished some work or some degree, are giving a year or two of service. And our commitment is to live together first as good neighbors, side by side in the houses. And in each house, there are little kitchenettes on each floor, but there's a common room, a common space, and we now have a little storefront area that is a common gathering space, not just for us, where we have all of our common events. It's the common space for the neighborhood now, which is really important. So we live side by side and we try to be good neighbors. And out of that, it doesn't remain just the charity model as you were talking about. Once you live side by side, once you really start to see how people are suffering from the systems that they are forced through, you are absolutely moved to advocacy and the work for justice. So the relationship becomes the passion for justice. Amen. I like that. Amen. And we continued the, we have continued the nighttime model, that within the houses we have no locks on any of the rooms. And when people come, they are taken aback by that at the beginning. And I say to them, I don't have a lock on my room because I trust you. And it's, this is, to me, a fundamental dynamic of hospitality, to say to people, we trust you. And in the process, we all become trustworthy. I have seen the same refugees going to social services offices where they are treated with suspicion. They are treated with suspicion almost everywhere. Why are you here? What are you doing? Are you a terrorist? That's the latest. But to begin with trust. And in fact, we all become trustworthy. Only once have I had anything stolen from my room. Only once. And it was by an Iranian man who was really mentally unstable, and he was in a haze one day and just walked off with a tiny radio, which he then returned. So the, we have lived in this, I think, a school of hospitality. And I take it as a great blessing. And I think the most important thing I want to say today, more than any of my analysis, is I really enjoy living in this situation. I really like it. And to me, that's the most important thing to say. We have very difficult days. We live with huge amounts of suffering. But in the midst of it, there's joy, happiness, purpose, and meaning. And I think that in all of our efforts at hospitality, if we can't enjoy it, we shouldn't be doing it. The worst thing is to, you know, which we often do in justice projects, we're kind of grim and guilty. And in the process, we diminish the people we're with. But to say, yes, we're with people, yes, we welcome them, and they welcome us. And it really was true what Jesus said. You'll be blessed. You'll be happy if you do that. And I think, you know, this is the good news about hospitality. It's not always easy. There's a lot of suffering. But it's a blessed way to be. And we only find that out by doing it and by trying. I want to say to people, you know, when I tell them occasionally, you know, I live with refugees, they say, oh gosh, that must be really hard. And I say, no, it is some days, but I'd rather be there. And you have no idea how much you're missing out on. You have no idea. And I just want to give you this one example of what I mean by that. It's just one of my favorite stories from Romero House. in the basement of the house where I live, there's a little boy from Burundi called Molly. And one of the neighbors on the street, who's an actress, comes by once a week to take Molly out to give the mum a break. So one day I was sweeping the front porch, and Barbara came to get Molly, and they went out for 2 hours, and they came back. And when they came back, I was still cleaning something, and Barbara said to Molly, "Tell Mary Jo what we did today." And Molly said, "We go shopping. I said, "Wow. And what did you buy?" He said, "We buy a goldfish." I said, "A goldfish, Molly? What's its name? Does it have a name?" He said, "Yes. He's about 6. And his English was very, very elementary at that point. "Yes. First, I call it George." It's from Burundi. I said, "Wow, George." He said, "Yes. First, I call it George. Then I think, and I think, and I call it Gloriana Clementine." And I just thought, how did George become Gloriana Clementine? What is going on in his head? I said to Barbara, "Where did you go? What were you doing?" And she said, "I don't know where that came from." But the imagination of this, it was so delightful. And so, you know, I just think people miss out on a lot when you don't see that. And the other thing you miss out when you're not in a school of hospitality, you miss the daily reminder that the gospel lives and walks off the page. I remember once over at the center cooking a supper for 20 people, a group of writers, and cooked all day. By 6 o'clock, nobody was there. I checked my date book and realized I had the wrong week. So I had all this food, so I literally went to the highways and byways, phoned the houses and said, "I have a great supper, come over." So about 20 people came over, and we're in the middle of supper, so the wedding feast, right? Those who were not invited came. We were having a great time. In the middle of the supper, the doorbell rings, which is unusual because we would have been closed. And a guy is standing there with his bag. He had just arrived at the airport. Somebody put him on a taxi to us. And he came in and said, in Spanish, "¿Qué pasa? You threw this party for me?" I said, "Well, yeah, I guess we did." Welcome to Canada. And it was just so real, that experience of the gospel. So in this school of hospitality, in which we are all students, you begin to see things differently, and the people that I have lived with, I think, have become the eyes of my eyes. And what I see is how deeply inhospitable we are as a culture. Deeply, deeply inhospitable. As a culture, and I want to make a very important distinction between personal attitudes and cultural attitudes. because it's too easy to say about people we know or people in our city, you know, they're not hospitable or this or that, to make it a personal fault or failing. But the thing, the deepest thing I've learned is it's not a personal fault or failing, primarily. It's a cultural fault line. And it's in the culture. It's embedded in the culture. It's in the air that we breathe. And it makes it possible for good people, kind people, to be very excluding, very inhospitable. And I think we shouldn't get all moralistic about this in a personal way. You, me, our faults and failings. What we need is this solid, clear look at the culture that we live in. So I see this now. I don't have special insight. It's just the people I've lived with have taught me how to see. And my strongest example, and it's in the basis of a big chunk of my book, Radical Gratitude, is the story of what happened to me one day as I was sitting on the back porch of our house, just like this, having a cup of tea, looking out onto the backyard. A young girl from Africa arrived at the front door, and I showed her a room and invited her for some tea. And we're sitting talking, looking out onto the backyard that I thought I knew. And she pointed and said, "Who live out there?" I said, "Nobody lives out there." She said, "Yes." I said, "No. I know my backyard. Nobody lives out there." "Yes. House out there. Person there." And I looked, and for the first time, I saw my backyard. I saw the house, the garage. And I said the only thing I could, which is, "It's a house for a car." And she said, "A house for a car? For a car?" I said, "Yeah, that's what it is. That's what a garage is." So we sat and looked at our garage, now stripped, revealed to be what it truly is. And this in a city that has a huge housing problem. So we looked and looked and said, "Okay, we'll turn the house for a car into a room for a person." And we made a big mistake because we had thought we should get a building permit, which is the law. So went down to City Hall, and to make people know, I know. Went around and around and around, and the conversation went something like this: "We want to turn the house for a car into a room for a person. You can't do that. Why?" "Because then everybody would do it." I would say, "Yes." I mean, great. This would solve the housing crisis. And I remember the terrified look of this official who just said, "But then there would be no room for the cars." Which to him was a bigger problem than having no room for the people. Now, this is not an anti-car rant. I have a car. We looked at, to make a long story short, we looked at the garage again and decided to turn it into a meditation room. But this time we wouldn't ask for a permit because we were sure there would be some law against having a house for God in your backyard. So, but what this did reveal to me was the core of the economic system that we live in which cars are more important than people, just to cut to the chase. And it provoked me to think deeply about economics, not just about banks and money, but it's a whole culture, a culture of money. And a culture that blinded me to what a garage was, what it really is. I couldn't see it because it was in me. This is normal. Cars have garages. Every house has one. Most houses have one, two, three. You get shocked into seeing how deeply, you know, we can talk about capitalism till the cows come home. But the deep spiritual thing is it's in us. Even if we don't have any money, it's in our mind and worse, in our spirit. So what I see as the deeply dispiriting reality of capitalism, consumerism, is that advertising especially sets up within us a craving for more. We have to be dissatisfied with what we have so that we will want to get something different, something better, something more. Our car is obsolete. We have to get a new one. You know, that type of thing. The clothes we wear. What I see in my own life is just the constant desire for faster, bigger, faster, smaller computers. You're just dissatisfied all the time with what you have. And this kind of dissatisfaction can afflict people like us as well, even if we don't have a lot of consumer goods or millions in the bank. I assume nobody here is in that situation. But the dissatisfaction can eat away at us. And the worst thing is when the dissatisfaction with things that fuels consumerism implodes and inverts within us. And so the feeling of I don't have enough becomes I'm not enough. I'm not enough. Or I'm not good enough. Deep sense of dissatisfaction with our very selves. And I think this goes, we were talking about this, Jin, it goes a long way towards some understanding of how is it that in the richest, most powerful culture on earth, so many people feel they're not good enough. They're powerless, guilty, but not guilty in an energizing way. Good guilt is extremely helpful. I did this, I made a mistake, do you know? Or we did this, so we should do something. But most people live with this general sense of guilt. I'm sort of responsible, but I have no idea what to do and can't. So the culture of money and the dissatisfaction leaves us with a constant sense of we don't have enough, and we're not good enough, and we can't do anything. So hospitality is just not on, because it assumes we have enough, we could do something, and we're good. It's just like a really hard thing to think about, as hard as to imagine what our garage really is. It seems like such a big deal to be hospitable, not because we're horrible people, but because we're going against a whole grain. The other thing in this culture of money that is so paralyzing, I think, is that it rests on this assumption that we can buy things, people, and we can sell. And it relies on the assumption that we can actually possess things if we pay enough money. And that attitude can expand to possessing people, places, even towards possessing God. And in the process, we become possessed by everything that we try to possess. And most people know that the minute we try to possess not just things, but people, the destruction of a relationship, of a marriage, of a community, when that happens. When we try to possess an idea, you know, this is mine, my copyright. When we try to possess God, it just disintegrates. Everything falls apart when we do that. So the culture of money and the spirit of dissatisfaction and possession makes hospitality difficult to imagine as a happy thing. I think also this economic system has its correlative in our political system, a political system based on the faith in progress, the American dream. If you just work hard, you think smart, things will get better, always. And if it doesn't get better, it's because we haven't worked hard and haven't thought smart. And we live in a political system of empire. I live in a sort of quasi-colony of empire. We're part of it. We know it exists. And fundamental to empire is it's got to keep growing. You're dissatisfied with what you have. You have to keep expanding, controlling, possessing. It's the inner dynamic of empire, expansion, and the importance of being able to say, we control this space. We control these resources. We control these people. We who live in the center of the world. So to begin to talk about hospitality, we have to go to the roots of this. The economic political system that incapacitates us, that's so profoundly dispiriting, that makes hospitality seem like weird instead of a happy thing to be. So I've pondered this question, and I think that the beginning of freedom from economic dissatisfaction that affects our spirits is gratitude. And I won't say all kinds of things about it this morning. You could read my book. This is not a promotion, but just to say there's more there. But I think that radical gratitude, not just gratitude for this or that thing, but radical gratitude begins with the simple awareness, the simple conviction that we have enough. It's to stop the craving for more, to stop this relentless desire to be more, to do more, and to say, who I am, just as I am, is good. That's what we were talking about. What we have is enough. It's a way of breaking the relentless cycle. And it's the beginning of hospitality. We have enough. We're good enough. We don't have to be saints to be hospitable. We don't have to be martyrs. We can do what we can do. Now, this doesn't mean that there aren't real reasons to be dissatisfied with real injustices in the world and to things that are really wrong in our churches. But when our lives are consumed by a profound dissatisfaction, our souls die. We have to take our ground in what we know to be good, not what's wrong, what we lack, but what we know to be good. We have enough. We have daily bread. And if we believe that we have daily bread, of course we will share it. And it will multiply. Which doesn't mean that there aren't very hungry people in the world who need bread. But to begin by saying we don't need more is the beginning of justice as well. The other thing I've come to think as I've reflected on hospitality is that it is first, as I said, liberated by gratitude. But it has to be grounded in a sense of the common good. Now, the common good in social theory and theology is a very evasive thing. Lots of people talk about it. Nobody defines it. And it's understandable why people are wary of defining the common good, particularly in a pluralistic society. We're nervous about one group or one church or one person defining what's good for everybody. And so we tend to lapse into a sort of liberal tolerance. You do your thing, I do my thing. You have your faith, I have my faith. And that's a very weak sense of common good. I have learned something new about what the common good looks like because of where I live. When we first moved into this little neighborhood, we were just about run out of town. And the first 2 years, the neighbors went to City Hall. They tried to get us out. It was very painful. And I can certainly remember the days saying, I'm not sure we're going to make it here. And they were just afraid because there were so many people of color, Muslim women in long dresses. They just thought this was terrifying. Tried to run us out. And over many, many years, and my big learning is social change is not the way they say in the books. It doesn't happen because you've got a good plan. It happens just if you stay long enough. And gradually, over many, many years and 1,000 acts of kindness on everybody's part, our four houses are now totally welcome and are seen as the major asset of the neighborhood and are seen as the catalyst to neighborhood. I'll talk more about that in the workshop. And so it's made me ponder, what is it that makes a neighborhood? It's not because we look alike. It's not because we think alike. We're the same. We're not the same economic backgrounds, same jobs, same religions. What holds a neighborhood together? And I've come to this simple realization that on the street where I live, which actually isn't much bigger than the length of this church, with four houses on each side, what we hold in common is the street. That's the good that we hold in common, the public space. And that street is what none of us own, but all of us are responsible for, and all of us use. Beginning with this sense of we know who's there, we look out for each other, we know the one old woman on the street who's really sick and has nobody to visit her. We look out for each other. We are not friends, but we are not enemies either. We're neighbors and we share a common space. Now, in a nutshell, I think the implications of that are huge. That a street or a set of streets, common space, is fundamental to creating relationships of neighborliness. And neighborliness helps to create common spaces. These are the spaces that nobody owns, but everybody shares it. So I'm saying this because I think most of the discussions of hospitality hinge on, as Jacques Derrida's model of hospitality, it assumes I'm in my house, I own my house. And it's up to me who comes in that door, because I own this. And the question is, if I let them in my door, what's going to happen to my house? Now, I don't think you get out of that conundrum as long as that's your model, because you still have the power to say yes or no. It's a function of your goodness or lack of it, or your hospitality, a moral question. And it's the model that's used politically. We own this house, we own this country, we will decide who comes in or who doesn't. And even I live in a city with really horrible mayor who's, we hope sincerely, will be arrested soon. It's a very uncharitable thought. But he was recently quoted saying after a wrestling match that he rigged, I own this city. And, you know, that's such a macho statement. And, you know, everybody, some people love it, but I own this city. Well, it means somebody else doesn't. It certainly means it's not our city. I own this city, and I'm here for the taxpayers. It's what you said last night about the taxpayers and the others. I own the city, we own the city, and we will decide who gets in and who gets out. But to say that there are public spaces and realities that are held in common, that there in fact is a table, and the table belongs to nobody, but it is shared by everyone. And once you say it is shared by everyone, hospitality becomes a natural outflow. We all share in this, and we are all responsible for it, for the table, for the street, for the city, for the country. The good, and ultimately the earth is the good that we hold in common. Now, we can each have spaces that we own, but fundamental to hospitality is this awareness that equally important are the spaces we share, the goods that we share. And there's a lot of thinking now on the commons. And there's a long history, a European history of the commons, you know, the meadows, which belong to nobody, shared by everybody. All those medieval churches built over generations were spaces that everybody built, everybody shared in, nobody owned. That those spaces teach us what is the ground and foundation of hospitality. So I think I'm going to just stop there. And we have about 15 minutes before the break. I'm really delighted to hear your questions, your comments. The conversation continues from last night, what Jin and Mark said.
Thank you so much for your comments. I feel like this is one of those moments in my life where I, you know, sort of feel like I'm in the midst of being reconverted, converted again, and to a deeper sense of what the gospel is about. And so I thank you for sharing that. I wonder, this idea of hospitality that you have learned over these years at Romero House, and the talk about the commons and about public and shared space, I wonder if you have, I'm interested to know if you have thought about all of this thinking in terms of our environmental crisis and in terms of public shared space and about the destruction of our global public space. I guess I'm just intrigued to hear how if you've, your particular window of seeing that crisis through your experience at Romero House. Thank you.
No, for sure, and I just didn't have time to say everything. But it has enormous implications. If we begin to say the earth is our common good, That's the fundamental starting point. Not some idea, not social construct, not something. This earth. And, you know, I was on a trip to the Arctic this summer, a study tour. I mean, if anybody doubts there's global warming, you just have to watch those icebergs crashing into the ocean off of Greenland. So the only question becomes, and what part of the earth is ours to be responsible for? So we have this, you know, the earth as something none of us own totally, we all share, we're all responsible for, but which particular part of the earth, which dimension? So it's about water and land and trees and fish and resources, also knowledge, information, economics, you know, all of this is part of the earth as the common good. Absolutely. And theologically speaking, to move from the ancient Platonic idea of the good as this noble ideal ahead of us, to the earth, the concrete, real planet, as what we hold in common, is crucial. Jordan, over here.
Just from a, you've already talked a little bit about some of the legal challenges that you've had to work off of, specifically with this house. I was wondering if, either at the level of the city or in partnership with people more broadly, what have been the political challenges that you've had? And I think of in the States, there's a trend towards increased privatization of public spaces, and that's something that happened in Europe as well. Mm-hmm. And you know, to what degree have you guys been involved in any kind of pushback?
And with what?
Any kind of pushback against that kind of increased privatization of public spaces? And how does that, how do those engagements look?
Mm-hmm. Politically speaking, I mean, we're living with a very, very conservative government in Canada, as you know. And the issue of natural resources is front and center. The oil in the country, specifically Fort McMurray, which I visited last year, is a huge issue. So just personally, I'm involved in the question of the oil and Fort McMurray, it's a whole other thing. But underlying the question of natural resources and care for the earth and a hundred other ways that the government is acting is this conviction that all we are is an economic being. In other words, the way governments talk about taxpayers, not citizens, but taxpayers. I mean, this is a huge diminishment of the human person, that that's all we are, is the money we give to the government. All we are is the work that we do, the money that we earn, and this sense that if we're just happy economically, everything's going to be okay. And I think that the person that actually challenged this the most was the Czech president, Václav Havel, in one of his essays in which he talks about the lie of materialism, which could be communism or capitalism. And the big lie is, you'll be happy if you just have enough things. If you have a job and a car and money, you'll be happy. And what he's saying, and I what I believe is that's not true. We need meaning and purpose in our lives. We need a reason to be joyful. Those are equally human tasks. So I'm kind of wandering around your question, but to me there's a huge link between present attitudes towards the environment and towards people, which is, it's all just economics. And the a number of times on the newscasts in the evening where it says the economy demands, it's like this great idol. Everybody, oh, the economy. You know, as if it's an immovable reality. Yes, there's a...
Morning. I don't really, I guess, have a question. I just wanted to thank you for your words. I think you just kind of hit the nail on the head when I was hearing you talk about the idea that there's this cultural failing, I guess, rather than individual, and thinking about the idea that there's always this perception that we need to have more and more things, and this lack of satisfaction with that ends up translating into a personal sense of lack of satisfaction and sense that we are not enough. Mm-hmm. I was like, does she know me? And but then to recognize it as this illness within our culture, really, I think is something that I am grateful to hear, and I have heard it from others in my community, but I wanted to thank you for reiterating that again in a way that helps it kind of stick and help to try and alleviate some of that sense of personal guilt, as though like I'm this terrible person because I can't do enough. And I think I am just really grateful to be here, and I want to thank you for pointing that out again.
Great. No, thank you. I just think it's essential, and this isn't just about hospitality. It's, you know, as long as we keep saying, you know, we're not good enough, we're not socially conscious enough, we're too sexist, we're too racist, we're too this, we're too old, too young, too white, too black, too, you know, all what we're not, somebody is laughing all the way to the bank. Really, it keeps us paralyzed. And we need to sort of say, you know, as we are, we all have faults. We all have blind spots. None of us is perfect. You have to begin with that. But to keep waiting until we're going to be fully perfect humans, we will never do anything. And I'm just at the point, maybe you just get there when you're older, maybe you just realize how urgent everything is. You know, when people say, well, you know, I only have my BA, I don't really know very much. And I say, I really don't care. Like, I really don't care. Just get on board. We've got to do this. You know, or I haven't traveled enough and I feel, you know, not socially, you know, haven't been involved. I say, it doesn't matter. And I think actually this is what Jesus did with the disciples. He just said, come as you are. Don't wait until you're ready. Like, with all your faults, failings, blind spots, cultural biases, come as you are. But as long as you sit on the sideline waiting, somebody is laughing all the way to the bank. The status quo remains. It does. Which doesn't mean we don't all try to, you know, be better. But don't let it get in the way. That's all I wanted to say. Yep.
Thank you, Mary Jo. So yesterday we kind of framed the conversation starting out with Jim Baer's Sacred Sites tour. And some of us from the Mennonite Worker have been up into Ontario with CPT in Indigenous or Aboriginal Justice Delegation. I know that that was in Kenora or and Grassy Narrows, which I don't believe is too far off from Toronto, though I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a ways. Okay.
It's a way, but I know where it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm just kind of curious how, if you've kind of seen some of the struggle of Indigenous communities there in more of an urban setting. So in Grassy Narrows, the big struggle is against resource extraction without mm-hmm. the consent of the community.
Yeah.
I'm curious how that is, if that's something that you've seen present in more an urban setting, like the struggle of that particular community,
mm-hmm.
And how that kind of plays out there.
Mm-hmm. It's absolutely at the heart of, certainly in Canada, but here as well, the national effort to reclaim any integrity on this question. As I understand it, the Aboriginal people's great economy was around the commons. A deep sense of what was shared by all, owned by none, but for which everyone was responsible. And yet are the people who have had all of that enclosed and taken over by governments, by corporations. The Aboriginals in the city, actually apparently they're way more in the city than outside the city, but so invisible largely. What I certainly have seen is that all of the major resource developments in the country, Fort McMurray's tar sands, are totally polluting the waters of the Athabasca River and all of the Aboriginal lands in that area where the cancer rate is skyrocketing. I've seen that. And in the Arctic, the Inuit, Nunavut, which is a very important exercise in self-government, 35,000 people trying to negotiate a future on top of huge mineral, oil, gold, everything that everybody wants to own, to possess. It's the central struggle of the country right now. Okay, so I think we're going to break and go into the workshops.